just say this is KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And my guest this evening is Jerome Corsi. And I'm going to let him talk a little bit about himself further. We have had him on in the past with when I had Dr. Carlstrom on as a co-host with me. But in the meantime, Jerome is talking about is just finishing a book. Is that correct?
I'm just finishing a book called it's called America for Sale, and it will be out, I believe, in October. Is I think the day we're dates we're scheduling, middle of October.
Okay, great. Well, if you'd give us a brief rundown of your background, and then just go ahead and get right onto this book. It sounds quite interesting, actually.
Well, I'm a reporter for WorldNet Daily. I report on WorldNet Daily on a regular basis. And I have written a number of books. My most recent books were The Late Great USA, which is now out in paperback, with $10 on Amazon. It's about the coming merger with Mexico and Canada, and under the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. And I also wrote The Obama Nation, which is the biography, a very critical biography of President Obama, arguing that he would be a very leftist president, very left-wing policies, and we'd end up with a militarily weakened United States. I think, as you know, those predictions are coming true, unfortunately. And the book, both of those were New York Times bestsellers. The Obama Nation was number one for a month, and that was on the list for, I think, over 10 weeks. So my new book, America for Sale, is on the same kind of theme as Late Great USA. It's on the theme that we are going to have to continue fighting for American sovereignty, and that this current crisis we're in, this economic crisis we're in, is one that will threaten to very seriously devalue the dollar and ultimately end up with the United States being for sale to Europe and the Middle Eastern oil-producing countries that have gained dollar assets through our failed economic policies.
Now, one question that we had brushed upon in the past, and you didn't seem to think there was a connection. Do you still think that there is no connection with the UN?
Well, no, I mean, I think I've been very critical of the UN. And I think the UN is, I say in this America for Sale, I say we should probably pull out of the UN, because the UN is an anti-American organization as far as I can see. It does not support the interests of the United States, and it is not, you know, it's, again, more international organizations which would be happy to compromise U.S. sovereignty. So on that basis, I'm very much opposed to the United Nations.
And are you familiar with Agenda 21?
Yes. And, again, that's, you know, that and the Millennium Project, which is part of There's several different UN projects and proposals and agendas that largely end up weakening the United States as a industrial nation and have policies which are counter to our sovereignty. The Agenda 21 is one of them. I mean, the UN has these meetings and these agendas, the Millennium meeting, and then they have an agenda and a protocol for it. When you read it, it calls for the industrial nations end up paying taxes or people to be concentrated in urban areas. There's a whole series of objectives that the UN continually presses, and they are all, I think, fundamentally antithetical to the freedoms that we as Americans enjoy.
Okay, and, I mean, I've been looking at this Agenda 21 thing quite a bit because I see the policies coming down on a local level, and that it helped play into some of this gutting of America. And maybe, you know, kind of tell us a little bit of how you illustrate what's going on.
Well, let's just take the Late Great USA, and let me tell you what the argument in the Late Great USA is. I look at the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America, which President Bush declared in Waco, Texas, on March 23, 2005, with Vicente Fox of Mexico and Paul Martin, who was then the Canadian Prime Minister. And the whole purpose of this Security and Prosperity Partnership is to create North American integration. If you take a look at the website, SPP for SamPeterPaul.gov, it's a government website, SPP.gov, created in the Department of Commerce. You can see that since 2005, we've had something like 21 or 22 working groups, which are our bureaucrats, Mexico's bureaucrats, and Canada's bureaucrats, meeting to integrate and harmonize our laws. Now, this is, again, the kind of effort that's undertaken to same way that the European Union economically integrated and then ended up ultimately in political integration. And I'm saying the same thing could happen with the United States going down the Security and Prosperity Partnership agenda. And very few Americans even know what's happening. So the goal of the SPP, which is to produce an administrative branch effort to integrate three countries, is done below Congress's awareness. There's no law, there's no treaty, but yet we're going to end up with comparable administrative regulations in the three countries, which is the beginning to a political union of the three countries. And I look at a lot of the research and a lot of the writing that goes behind the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Council on Foreign Relations and Robert Pastor, who is a professor at American University, it's very clear that there is a concerted effort by the intellectual elites who are supporting Security and Prosperity Partnership to end up with a North American Union, very much like in Europe there's a European Union, and ultimately with a new currency like the Amero, the A-M-E-R-O, to replace the dollar.
You know, I haven't heard a whole lot about the Amero lately. Is there any reason why you think that, or is it just me that's out of the loop on that?
I think that recently the discussion's been that the dollar's under such stress, the emphasis has gone even maybe out to a one-world currency quicker. You see discussion that happened at this latest G20 meeting in London, where China proposed that what we need is to use the International Monetary Fund and to take the special drawing rights of the International Monetary Fund and use them as a foreign exchange reserve currency for the world. Now, if that were to happen, that would replace the dollar as a foreign exchange currency. And again, I think it's the kind of moves you see being taken to position what ultimately ends up being the demise of the dollar. And I think that's the plan, whether it goes to the Amero as a North American currency first or whether it goes to a foreign exchange reserve currency like the SDRs at the International Monetary Fund, it's clear that the pressure is still on by those who want to see the dollar replaced. It's just a matter of what the strategy is going to be that ultimately is used to make it happen.
And, I mean, my understanding is that more of this is actually in position and in place, and it's just a matter of them announcing that it's already been implemented. Am I correct, or is I'm just...
Well, I think a lot of it is discussed, and a lot of it is looked at. I mean, certainly Vincenti Fox has continued to give speeches. He was in the United States in San Antonio recently, and he was talking again about North American Union, and he was talking again about a common currency. So it goes on. Now, whether, people say, well, the currency's printed and they're waiting to issue it, I don't think it's at that point. But it's certainly when the intellectual elites are talking about it, when the discussions have advanced to the International Monetary Fund and the G20. The dollar is clearly under the, I predicted in Lake Great USA that the dollar would have a dollar crisis. There was no way that the dollar could continue to be strong when you've got our dependence on foreign oil and the amount of money that we're continually sending to China for a negative balance of trade. There's no way that the dollar can remain strong. And now you've got the Obama administration in, and the Obama administration is going to engage in trillions of dollars of debt and deficit spending. So it's inevitable the dollar is going to come under stress. And the plan is, you know, people would never give up the dollar unless, of course, the dollar were near worthless. And the dollar is made to be, well, then, and people feel in crisis, people will certainly say, okay, well, we'll have to go to a new currency in order to save the United States or save the economy, even if in the process we abandon the dollar. Certainly, it was sold that way in Europe when people in Europe were told how much better the euro was going to be for them. And I think right now there's a lot of discussion in Europe that the euro, you know, has eliminated the ability of the individual countries to run their own monetary policies.
So then, in other words, they found out it was kind of an excuse that had nothing to back it up?
Well, when you come to the euro, now Italy or France or Germany, when they want to have their own national monetary policy, can't, because there isn't any lira. There's no mark, French mark or German mark or French franc, so there's no central bank ability to set the rates and to really conduct monetary policy for any of these countries. They have to do it at the European Union level. That's the bureaucrats who run the European Central Bank who make the decisions. So I think people, that's a loss of sovereignty and it's a loss of control of the national economies where the European Union is in control of making the decisions. And that's where I'm pointing out the same thing could happen in the United States if we created a North American central bank and a new currency like the Amero.
Do you think it would even go to a North America? I was getting the impression that they were just going to jump right into one central bank for the world.
It's possible. I mean, certainly, that's what I was saying, the discussions that have been occurring lately, where you see how much they're looking at the United Nations to create, you know, use the International Monetary Fund to create a currency. It could happen that there could just be a creation of a, at least for foreign exchange reserves, of a foreign currency right away for the world. That's a possibility.
Well, I would also find that if the Europeans have already found out that they may have been misled, I can't imagine them being too anxious to jump into another currency on a world level.
Again, it's a matter of the dollar being so weak. Right now, a lot of nations, including China, don't want to hold dollar reserves anymore. And so they're looking for an alternative.
Uh-huh.
Now, the alternative may be something like this International Monetary Fund decision to put up the special drawing rights as a alternative to the dollar for settling international trade. It's a foreign exchange reserve currency. If that happens, you could have the euro and the International Monetary Fund being the two standards that Europe uses. The euro used among the European countries and the International Monetary Fund's SDRs for international trade, and the dollar would be out of the picture.
So on those special drawing rights, is there anything that is the equivalent of that now?
Special drawing rights exist now, but they are not robust enough. There's not enough backing behind them in order to be what you know the G20 wants them to be. Now, if they're talking about putting between $250 to $500 billion to support the issuance of the special drawing rights as a currency. If they do that, the International Monetary Fund gets that kind of funding from the members who belong to it, then I think you're going to see a great advancement of the special drawing rights being used especially by the developing world as the first alternative to the dollar. And if that begins to happen, you'll step by step put in place the mechanism where the dollar could be replaced. I think that's likely how it's to happen. Most of these developments occur incrementally, step by step. And this has already been proposed. So when I wrote about it in the Late Great USA and said, look, this is going to happen, I think a lot that I wrote there has now been fulfilled. The dollar crisis has happened. I wrote in the late Great USA, I said, here's why the economy is going to begin to falter. I predicted that we would have the bubble bursting on housing. And these are the conditions which are needed to make the dollar weaken. With a weakened dollar, there's going to be a need for new solutions. And that's going to be where I think the new currency proposals, either a regional currency like the Amero or an international currency, are going to get proposed.
Do you get into the historical means that this has come about? Do you get into that in your book?
Well, I mean, I certainly trace it in the late Great USA, and I also trace it in the Obama Nation, that you've got a lot of the globalists who have been at this for Council on Foreign Relations or other intellectual interests. I take a look at Robert Pastor's work. He is this professor at American University, and Pastor has consistently argued that we need, he wrote a book called Towards a North American Community, that we need to think like North Americans. And that, you know, we need, instead of thinking like U.S. citizens, let's think like North Americans. When you look at the border being left wide open, I make the point that our border with Mexico is not accidentally being left wide open. That's part of, again, a plan. And when you take a look at the plan, we now have close to, we're going to soon have, I think, 20% of Mexico's population living in the United States as Mexican national citizens. We'll have close to 50 Mexican consular offices here, and the consular offices protect the rights of the Mexican nationals to live in the United States as Mexican citizens. These are steps which erode our sovereignty.
I've actually heard a Canadian citizen call into a program saying that we've got like the North American Command, I believe, there in Canada, and some FBI offices and that sort of thing up there. Are you familiar with any of that? Or?
Well, yes, I've written about that as well, okay. On WorldNet Daily, that we have, our military and the Canadian military have formed an agreement to be able to work with each other in the case of domestic emergencies. So you could actually have Canadian military in the United States or U.S. military in Canada that would be involved in a domestic emergency situation in either country. You know, they're Canadian military operating in the United States. It's conceivable.
Okay, but it was that sort of action done in Europe when they did their merging?
To some extent, although, you know, the Mexican governments outside of these as well. Mexico has not entered these arrangements yet. And in Europe, there's really not a European Union army. There's, you know, mostly Europe's countries, the countries in Europe have largely demilitarized. So their armies are much smaller than they used to be. That was one of the goals of the European Union. The European Union doesn't yet have an army or a foreign policy. But what we're doing in North America is that we're using the U.S. military through U.S. NORTHCOM to be involved potentially in domestic emergency situations, and that's new. We've never done that before.
I'm just wondering if they're not being ready to be the the defense of the world, not just this country, and maybe why they didn't get into that in Europe.
It's possible, although I think that the focus right now on U.S. NORTHCOM, I mean, that concerns me, is that, first of all, we have not used the military in domestic emergency situations. So I've gone out to U.S. NORTHCOM, I've attended some of the exercises, and it's right now very clear that U.S. NORTHCOM's aware that there's very limited situations in which the military become involved. A natural hazard, an emergency like Katrina, or a case where there would be a pandemic flu or a health emergency where the military was needed on a limited basis. But once you start training the military and getting a command set up for the military to be used internally as a domestic police force, you created the conditions where you have to be concerned that It could lead to martial law or to suppression of freedoms in the case of a political protest or otherwise. You know, let's say the economics continue to deteriorate and people begin protesting in the streets. Well, we have a military command that could be called by the president to intervene in those situations.
Don't we have kind of a quasi-martial law in effect now anyways?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a martial law in effect right now. I mean, it's certainly the potential there at any time. Right now, there's not military in the streets. There's not military deployed in the United States domestically. But the potential is there for it to happen. And it would all depend upon how the president called an emergency. And you know, I've worried about and written about in World Net Daily, and also I've discussed it in The Abomination, that you've got these national security declarations where the president on his own authority, and George W. Bush signed these into law with an executive order. The president can declare an emergency on his own authority without consulting Congress and then get out and deploy the National Guard or the military to be involved in the situation. And again, that's outside the norms of what we've typically done.
You want to get in a little bit on what you put in, wrote about in Abomination? Or
certainly. I mean, Abomination, I tracked Barack Obama's career. And Barack Obama's leftist politics, you can start with his community organizer. Barack Obama talks about being a community organizer. Well, in Chicago, Barack Obama worked at a Saul Alinsky organization, and it was a developing communities project that he worked on. And Saul Alinsky, of course, was a radical organizer. People remember Saul Alinsky from the 1960s. Saul Alinsky wrote a book called Rules for Radicals, and he taught that the militants should cut their hair and run for office and gain political power so you can redistribute income. The whole goal was a socialist, if not an outright communist, redistribution of income from the haves to the have-nots. In fact, Saul Alinsky dedicated his book to Lucifer. He said it was the first radical. And Saul Alinsky says in the beginning of his book, Rules for Radicals, that he wrote the book for the, you know, Machiavelli wrote The Prince, Saul Alinsky says, for the haves to keep with the have. And Alinsky declared that he was writing the Rules for Radical for the have-nots to take it away. Well, I think you've got a situation right there where mm-hmm. Barack Obama was learning and working as a young man in his formative years in a organization that was redistribution of wealth. And that's been a consistent theme even till today, where we have a $3.6 trillion budget, $787 billion economic stimulus package, and the goals are to redistribute wealth. Massive expansion of the government, massive expansion of the social welfare system. That's what Barack Obama's always been about.
Well, I've run across a situation when I've watched, you know, the Bush administration on how that created a certain knee-jerk reaction, it seems, to the people that I know, that now I'm seeing them think that socialism is a total acceptable form of politics now, when in the past I would have not seen those people saying that. Are you following what I'm saying?
There have been some surveys showing, and again, I think we're teaching the kids in the school far too much socialism and communism, and have been doing that since the 1960s. Take a look at our textbooks or take a look at the history or politics that are taught in the school. It's a very leftist version. I mean, Howard Zinn, political scientist, is commonly taught. If anyone's read any of his books, they're about the United States being an imperialist power, you know, right out of socialist thinking, capitalist, imperialist power, and the history of the world is taught through American history as being exploitation of labor by capital. So as we teach students this, the Barack Obama generation is not as thoughtful as the need for or the reasoning behind preserving capitalism. I think that's a very much of a loss that we're going to have to suffer for, that we haven't prepared the next generations to understand that the free enterprise system is the only one that works.
Well, I think, just from my observation, I think we got to see the ugly side of capitalism, and so that seemed to create this knee-jerk reaction to this socialistic acceptability, but they haven't gotten to see the ugly side of the socialism yet.
Well, there's always faults no matter what you look at, but in terms of the ability to generate wealth, free enterprise has been by far the system that's proven to create the highest living standard for people. People can work and benefit from their own labor, can create capital and business that's private, not government controlled. That formula works. Government control tends to be a very poor formula for producing wealth. The farms, the collectives that were run by the Soviet Union, the attempts to run factories or an industrial state, all these have failed under central government management. And the private enterprise system, where people can put capital at risk, gain or lose by their efforts, that system's been proven to work. And now what we're having is a redistribution of wealth. Now, half the people in the country no longer pay taxes. In fact, about 20% of the people get tax refunds and don't pay taxes, and through various kinds of earned tax credits. So if only half the people are paying taxes, that's an unstable system, because the half not paying will vote themselves more social welfare benefits to the point where incentive is entirely withdrawn from the people who are earning money.
Well, I don't know.
What's
the difference between a bailout and and welfare?
Well, I think the bailouts are a bad idea, too. We had a much better opportunity to let companies like GM or Chrysler declare bankruptcy and reorganize. What's going to end up happening is the taxpayers are going to get stuck for all the legacy union benefits, all the retired union workers, which right now are the stopping point, the stumbling block in the negotiations. And the retirement benefits, the wage benefits, the health benefits, all that was promised to the retired United Auto workers is really why there's no way that you can save GM or Chrysler. Now, if the government tries to manage a bankruptcy, I'm sure that part of the strategy will be to protect those UAW legacy benefits. And that's not to the benefit of the economy or the benefit of Chrysler or GM. A bankruptcy, ordinary bankruptcy, would have given the GM and Chrysler the opportunity to eliminate or substantially reduce those legacy benefits without them having to go onto the taxpayer. That's the problem.
Well, when you say taxpayer, do they include sales tax and that sort of thing when they're talking about taxes?
It depends. I think the main consideration, I think the primary concern right now is the income tax, because you've got half the people in the country not paying income tax at all.
But then I hear the argument about that the income tax really only pays something on a deficit, and that it really goes to some private bankers. So does that? I don't see how that benefits the country in any way as it is.
Well, I think we probably ought to eliminate the income tax. I think this whole idea that half the country is not paying income tax and the other half is going to pay income tax is unstable.
Right, right. And I see it kind of becoming an argument and then a non-argument, because it's not even really should be part of the argument, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, the problem is income tax still exists, and until it's eliminated, you're going to have, you saw it in the Tea Parties, people are out and protesting and saying essentially they just don't want to pay these taxes anymore. Not when we're having trillions of dollars in budgetary deficits. don't look like there's going to be any end to them at all. And you've got a situation where, you know, the federal budget at $3.6 trillion, which is what President Obama is proposing for 2009 budget, this is just unsustainable. You can't have these kinds of massive deficits and have the dollar stay in any way sound, because right now China's been, and Middle Eastern oil producing companies have been, buying treasury securities to pay for these deficits. China is going to closely, pretty soon here, say they don't want to do it anymore.
Well, I thought there's also that it doesn't it put us at risk on our land and resources if we, with so much of it being debt?
Well, certainly right now, I mean, right now the only thing behind our debt is the full faith and credit of the United States. There's not been any pledge of land or pledge of anything else behind the debt that's bought. I know there were stories circulating when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to China. There was an agreement to give China eminent domain powers, but that was not the case. I mean, that was not done. And, you know, it would be, the truth is, that's probably not the way it would happen, because eminent domain powers, if China got eminent domain powers and China had to start grabbing land in order to get the debt paid, that'd be tantamount to having a war. I think what'll happen is there'll be a different set of structures used, more like public-private partnerships, and over time, China's going to get guarantees by the federal government to make investments back in the United States. I think there'll be an effort to get China to reinvest some of the dollars that China's now holding as not debt, but as investment capital in the United States. So there's going to be guarantees, I think, given to give China reason to put some of that money back into the United States. But I doubt if it'll be through eminent domain and property. But what I'm saying is that we're America's for sale. We are basically putting the country into a position of weakness when we have these deficits, and the only way we can finance the deficits is by selling this debt to China.
And that's where I was thinking that the, not so much as eminent domain, I would think that eminent domain would be used more so by our government, and in the way that they're acquiring land through various means puts that, you know, just adds another layer to doing that, where they could possibly sell the resources or infrastructure or whatever off to foreign governments.
Well, that's in the process of happening. I think the right now these public-private partnerships are the first, where you have seen various states take highway projects and make them either new projects or existing roads to make them into toll roads and let foreigners invest in the roads and then have the right to collect the leases on those roads for 50 or 60 years after the roads are built or redeveloped. And that's the beginning of foreign ownership of U.S. infrastructure.
Right. And I believe it goes back to, like, the Rio Earth Summit or something of that sort, where you had Maurice Strong talking about bringing this country down to a third world status. Are you familiar with his statements?
Well, I've seen it, various of them, and I think what's happening is that, you know, I've argued and do argue in the America for Sale that the globalists have intentionally kept the borders open and put the United States into competition with foreign labor to reduce labor costs in the United States. And as such, this tremendously puts pressure on the standard of living in the United States, so that over time, the middle class is squeezed, and that's what's going on right now. People are seeing jobs outsourced to China. Those jobs are not coming back anytime near soon, including now white-collar jobs. India can compete for accountants and lawyers, call services, all kinds of other white-collar services.
Medical?
Medical, sure, medical, especially when it comes to medical accounting.
Well, my understanding is, you know, I mean, well, shoot, when you'd go to a doctor in a lot of these cities, you were running across a lot of these foreign doctors over here. But when you look at the budget, that the congressional budget that they had, I think it was, back in January or February, they had a huge allotment there for medical records data.
Yes.
And that, to me, signals the gutting of our medical profession as a profession, other than to make them technicians. We may be going to Walmart to get our prescriptions and our protocol for our health.
Well, certainly the record-keeping that's done under these kind of new proposals of the Obama administration to put records into computerized systems, this record-keeping will be done at the in India, because it can be done much more cheaply outsourced. And that's part of the problem. Is part of the problem you've got is with the outsourcing, with the continued putting money out from the United States to do these jobs in foreign countries, you're creating a situation where U.S. workers are being unemployed in these areas, and the wages in general are lowering. That's going to put pressure on our standard of life. There's no, the whole outcome of the New World Order or the outsourcing of jobs or globalism ends up putting pressure on U.S. wage earners. And that's part of the difficulty, is that, you know, with U.S. wage earners earning less, the middle class is struggling. Talking about reducing the United States to a lower standard of living, these are the steps through which it happens. And they are underway. They are taking place.
So who's going to be the winner in this? Is it just going to be a few oligarchs at the top?
Well, there's, you know, both on the left and the right, there are pressures to create globalism. I think on the left, the, you know, people want to redistribute income. Barack Obama and Saul Alinsky, who believe the United States is a, you know, a country that needs to be eliminated or dramatically reduced, they think there'll be a more just distribution of income, the way the socialists always want. You know, the whole idea is to import an underclass from Mexico and to open up our jobs to third world labor around the world and not to the benefit of the U.S. worker. From the conservatives, from the right, it's like the David Rockefeller Republicans. Their view is that cheaper labor, the multinational corporations are the winners, because the multinational corporations will get cheaper labor wherever they can find it, even if it's using slave labor in China. I mean, that's the argument I'm making in the late great USA. It's the argument I make again in America for Sale, is that you've got a whole movement toward multinational corporations from the right actually benefiting from cheaper labor. But it's very short-sighted, because ultimately if you undermine the very middle class on which the consumer society depends, because people don't have the incomes to spend the money they need, then you're going to find exactly what we're finding right now. And that is, the recessions that we enter into are going to be very deep and very long recessions, because the jobs are not going to come back immediately, and the spending is not going to come back immediately.
You know, what I seem to observe, and I don't know if this is correct or not, but what it seems to me is like the globalists, whether they do what auspices or paradigm that they set, I mean, like they set up America, it became the industrial center. Now they've moved it over to Asia. Who's to say that they're not setting Asia up for the same situation that they're doing to us?
Well, this is where I say that in the late great USA and also in America for Sale, both books, I'm arguing that we need to make sure American workers are paid a living wage. You know, got to have labor being part of the overall capital equation so that it's paid for. as well as benefits. If we say that, oh, it's going to be okay as long as we let the multinational corporations go for the cheapest possible labor anywhere in the world we can find it, we're putting America for sale.
Right.
And that's the problem, is that the multinational corporations don't bear any allegiance to the United States of America. Their allegiance is to quarterly profits.
Well, I'm not too sure we have any control over it, and I'm not too sure that those that are on the in the UN or whatever group that they want to create, because there's hundreds of them from what I understand, that the people are even being told the truth that are voting or think they have a say in what's going on, when it's still just a few at the top that are deciding how, you know, everything's run.
Well, the in general, America, this I think was so interesting about the Tea Parties, is that you're finding Americans are now saying taxation without representation. I think there's a feeling that among Americans that, again, the wild spending, the dramatic expansion of government, and the deficit spending are so out of control that Americans feel they're losing touch with their government, that America is for sale, very much the same way that the colonists felt in rebelling against Great Britain, that they didn't have representation because no one was listening to them. And our politicians are not listening to the American people again. We have Barack Obama engaging in taking essentially the economic downturn as an opportunity for a wild expansion of government.
Is it expansion of government or just expansion of bureaucracy?
Well, that's what they're doing. That's what the same thing.
Okay.
With the expansion of the bureaucracy comes greater government powers. And right now the only employment sector that's growing in the United States is government service. And
yeah,
that's not growing at the state level, it's only at the federal level.
So that's how they buy off the public to not they're not serving their own interests by being bought off to be put into these bureaucracies which destroy the healthy aspects of a country's economy.
Well, the problem with the government expansion is the government is not productive. It doesn't make anything.
Right.
It lives off taxes. So you've got states, I was up in Maine, and realizing in Maine, you've got, you know, increasingly half the population is going to be either retired or unemployed or government workers. Now, when you've got that being the case, the state is at a very difficult position because half the state is unemployed one way or the other, even government service. Yes, they're working, but they're working from tax dollars. They're not working off of profits or revenue from something that they themselves make or create.
Well, now there's an interesting angle to that because I went and followed this up because I had reviewed a video by John Harris, I believe, that spoke of a lot of these government entities are listed on Dun & Bradstreet. So there is income being made by a lot of these government entities.
Well, at least they have revenue from taxes or revenue from regulations one way or the other. But that's not genuinely true revenue. It's not the same as you make a product and sell it.
Uh-huh.
That's, you know, much more of a direct economic benefit and a direct economic source of revenue.
In other words, revenue is coming more from fines and that sort of thing.
Not just from taxes.
Yeah, right. Or from fees and things of along that line.
Well, hopefully something that reflects work being done, something
right.
productive.
And, right.
You know, the government regulators are not productive. They're enforcing regulations, they're enforcing laws, they're redistributing income. But if you go back to the Founding Fathers were very suspicious of big government. They wanted limited government. And we've gone in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, when you got such a large part of our GNP has to be our military and our penal system, I mean, that in itself is a monster to deal with.
Well, I argue again in America for Sale that we've got to get back to some basic principles. We've got to reduce the size of government. I'm watching very carefully these sovereignty movements, these resolutions that are getting passed in various states under the 9th and 10th Amendments, which say powers that are not specifically enumerated at the federal government are reserved for the people and the states. I think that's a very important movement. I think it's the beginning of a reversal of a trend where the federal government has usurped powers that were never intended for the federal government.
I kind of see that as a double-edged sword in a sense, because when you start looking at how various aspects of Agenda 21 has been brought down to our local level and where they've been taking away your city and county sovereignty towards these council of governments, which kind of erase become regions, and these regions don't have elective people, then we're kind of stepping into an area that possibly sets us up to go into the Soviet system.
Well, I'm saying we shouldn't be in regions. We shouldn't be in a federal government with massive powers.
Mm-hmm.
We should be in states that have most of the power. And the state sovereignty movement will, for instance, say to the federal government, we don't want your welfare money. We'll run state welfare.
And how about grant money, too?
Well, you know, a whole series of things. Federal hospital money, federal school money. I think states are getting very close to saying, we don't have to accept all of this federal money. Because with the federal money comes federal mandates.
Right.
Federal control. The states could say, look, in this state, under the 9th and 10th Amendments, the Constitution doesn't specify the federal government is supposed to be providing food stamps. So we're going to reject that. In our state, we're not going to provide food stamps. Now, if somebody wants food stamps, they want to move to the neighboring state, fine, let them go. But our state is not going to necessarily have food stamps as part of the provision of benefits to the people in the state.
Uh-huh.
I think that's within a state's rights.
Well, and now I'm starting to see the term super states, which would be, in a sense, kind of a way of doing these regions. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I mean, certainly when the international organizations want to set up regions, they're moving in that direction. Again, it's an attack on state sovereignty. It's an attack on any structure that's not locally controlled. I mean, I think we've got to go back to the Constitution. And remember,
right,
the Constitution, the states are the predominant sovereign. It is not the federal government. The states are the sovereign.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree in that at all. It's just that I just kind of almost wonder when, with these states going towards this 10th Amendment, and there's aspects of it that I've seen argued that, you know, that I'm not even sure I totally grasp at all, because I'm not even sure if some of the arguments I'm seeing are even logical in their usage or not.
Well, the 9th and 10th Amendments are very simple. The founders wanted a limited government. They said, we're going to enumerate powers of the federal government. They were very limited, coining money, raising an army, protecting national defense. It was very limited things the federal government was supposed to do. And they said, outside of that, all things not specifically enumerated to the federal government are powers reserved to the states and to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's an important formulation, because it means you can't read a new power into the Constitution. A lot of what we're dealing with today is created and read into the Constitution, like the welfare state. There's no discussion of a welfare state in the Constitution. And so you can say, okay, if you want to run the welfare state, run it in somebody else's state, but not in ours.
So do you have any kind of a, I hate to use the term hope anymore.
What?
I hate to use the term hope anymore. A positive aspect on how this can be done.
Yeah, let's just conclude this way. I'm writing these books because I think that in the final analysis, Americans are not ready to give up U.S. sovereignty. And if Americans can see the globalism plans and can see through, you know, the intellectual basis of the argument that we need to have open borders or outsourcing, and see the damage that's going to be done to the U.S. economy, it'll be stopped. And I'm looking for movements like the sovereignty, state sovereignty movement, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments. I was very encouraged with the Tea Parties. I think we've got to get back to more limited government and more constitutionally defined government.
What about the attack on the Second Amendment, too?
Got to make sure we continue to keep the Second Amendment intact. We need to have the gun rights preserved. So these are the things I feel very strongly about, and I'll begin to continue to write on WorldNet Daily, and I continue to write new books. The America for Sale will be out in October. And it's been a great pleasure to be with you. So we got a chance to really explain some of these in a little more detail today.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to, you know, to come back and let us know what you're up to and where we are.
Well, great. I'll be continuing to write on WorldNet Daily. I've got a new newsletter called Red Alert. You can see it at Red Alert at redalert.wnd. You've got to type all that in. redalert.wnd.com. It's an economics newsletter, strategic economics issues. And my book, America for Sale, will be out in October. The Late Great USA is available in paperback. And we got the paperback down to $10 on Amazon.com with a new conclusion in it that brings it up to current. But you can see how the move for a North American Union is continuing, and the America for Sale will show how that ties into globalism.
And is this, do you have a regular website, too? Or
a WorldNet Daily. I'm writing on WorldNet Daily as a senior staff reporter on a constant basis.
Okay, and one other thing is on the, where do you see the, I mean, with Obama, and does this, I mean, is he going to factor into this being able to, how do I want to say this, for the people of this country to be able to wake up and understand that you know, he
Well, I think it's happening. I think Obama is a globalist. I think the Tea Parties and the resistance to his spending are the beginning. I expect the Obama administration could end up being like the Jimmy Carter administration, very out of touch, very naive, and having led us down paths that weaken us economically and militarily, and I think the American people will reject it. And
okay.
It's good to be with you, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Goodbye.